Great to have you with us on WPIR News. Larry Mueller here, and welcome to another edition of our Outdoor Writers Roundtable. Going to spend some time talking about hunting, conservation issues, and the latest news from the Wisconsin DNR and Natural Resources Board. With our three guests back with us once again, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Pat, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Appreciate you being with us. Dean Boritz with us as well, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. I'm sorry. Dean, welcome back. Thank you.
Yeah, hey, everyone. Good to be back.
And Tim Isley, freelance outdoor writer and private landowner in Crawford County. Tim was one of the original founding members of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association back in 1976. Tim.
Right. Great to be here with you again, Larry. Thank you very much.
We want to hear from you as we talk together about the hunting seasons. We can talk. We're certainly going to be talking about a whole broad range of outdoor issues over the next couple of hours here. And I hope you'll join in with a wildlife issue that may be at the top of your mind. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dean Boritz, I heard you spent some time out in Montana with a little hunting. Maybe, you know, that's one of the things we do in the fall.
Yeah, I sure did. It's been a lot of fun. A lot of friends from Wisconsin came out during that time, did some antelope hunting. One group did some antelope hunting, and two of the guys ended up each getting an antelope buck off the same area, shot at different times. Animals were 300 yards apart, but the second one ended up running to within 5 yards of the first one and keeled over. And so they were able to work on both animals right there, break them down, and get them out of the field. So that was kind of interesting to have both animals just fall dead next to each other.
Here we've got the gun deer season opens this Saturday. Pat, what are you looking forward to during this gun season?
I'll be hunting in near home for the first time in about 40-some years, I guess. I'm hunting up in Chippewa County on a friend's farm about 12 miles from home. So that's going to be a new experience. I have two grandsons coming along this year, and my oldest daughter is bringing her boy, and then the boy who lives in town here, 7-year-old grandson, he's coming with me. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's things have changed a lot over the. I mean, we're not young anymore. None of the four of us here,
right.
and thinking about my own group of people, where our original group of 10 is down to 4, but there are kids and grandkids that are sort of filling in that gap. Is that similar for you, Dean? Or
yeah, we end up usually going back to our family's farm in Southern Ashland County, where we'll open up the season again this year. And over the last few years, we've had a few youngsters coming up. Last year, we added our granddaughter Charlotte Lottie. She was 7 then. She's almost 8 now. So she's looking forward to coming back. And she has a 4-year-old sister who may show up at camp on Friday night. And Friday night, what we do is play shake dice and play cards for big money, nickels, dimes, and quarters. And last year, Lottie, she cleaned us out. She had no idea what she was doing. But on Saturday, when we went to my mother's, it's only about a half a mile, 3/4 mile away for breakfast. My mom heard the story of how Lottie cleaned us out and had this pocket full of cash. So she went and found her mother's change purse and gave it to Lottie. So on Saturday night, Lottie had a little zippered change purse that she was meeting out her quarters and nickels and dimes at, and then smiling every time she got to rake in a pot.
It sounds like fun. Tim, what about you?
Well, I'll be heading over to Crawford County to hunt our property, and normally I'll be joined by my youngest brother, Mike, who will be up. And so we usually get together over there and spend several days out in the woods. And we originally started, 25 years ago or so. I had one of the other brothers, Todd, who graduated in natural resources at UW Stevens Point and was really the avid deer hunter in the group. So we started with him, and he brought one of his sons along, but Todd had passed away. So Mike and I keep the tradition on, and we'll be over there and just enjoy being out in the woods and seeing what we see in the woods, because you never can tell. You know, the trail cameras get some of the photos that I've been looking at, and been watching some bobcats that have been showing up over there. And we didn't really see a lot of deer sign early, I think because of the warm weather. But then just about a month ago, all of a sudden, we start seeing all the scrapes. And you see those big scrapes, and you know that there's something big making them. So, you know, it just you're looking forward to it.
And for a lot of us people, I think it's getting together with the same group that right. you've been together with for a long, long time. And I look forward to that as much as anything. And then just sitting in the woods.
Yeah.
I've seen bear. I had a wolf that kind of did a little drive for me once when I was up in a tree and watched it come across an opening and marsh and sort of walked in front of me by quite a ways. And I thought, well, if there was any deer there, they would certainly be heading maybe toward me. But that's part of it. And the birds and the grouse and everything else that you see is really something.
And even as a landowner, Larry, that you probably know, I interviewed a lady, the very first National Tree Farmers of the Year in Wisconsin, Rachel Jordan, down in Dodgeville. And one of the interesting comments she made to me was that when she's up in her deer stand, that's when she manages her land. So you're sitting there, exactly what you're saying, and you're looking and you're seeing trees. And, oh, there's a tree over here. Here's some box elders over here. Okay, later on in the year, I've got to get over there and cut those. And managing the trees. So that's really a good way to do it from your deer stand.
Yeah, it is indeed. I was thinking about climbing up my tree stand one morning. It was pitch dark yet, and I got to my stand and I pulled things up and I stood up and there was a grouse that was about 1 foot over the and a branch about 1 foot over my head.
Wow.
And when it took off, yeah. I almost fell out of the. It certainly gets your attention.
Yes.
When something like that happens. Joe in Madison has a question, not about deer, but about something else. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Does Wisconsin have a wild boar population? And what's being done to contain it?
Tim, do you want to start?
Sure. I haven't heard much about wild boars lately, but in the past, they had a problem with wild boars, especially down in Crawford County. And so I know that USDA APHIS and the DNR, they were encouraging people, if you saw wild boars, to report them. And if you were out in the field, you could shoot them. And I know somebody who did shoot a really big wild boar. But to be honest with you, lately, I have not heard of many people seeing wild boars, but they're very destructive. And you want, if you've got them around, you want to get rid of them. But I haven't heard much. I don't know if the other guys have, but I haven't heard much of it lately.
Anything for Pat?
I have not heard a thing about it in years.
I think they may have been extirpated. Joe, I don't think if there are any left in the state, mm-hmm. and we're not sure how they got there, they might have been released. It's possible that was the case. The few that were released were eventually eliminated. Well, I thank you, Joe, for calling. You can join in too at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. the biggest challenge is facing, I think, the deer herd is probably CWD. You guys have any comments on it? We've talked about this in the past on the show. It's a vexing problem, and there doesn't seem to be any solutions short of, all right, here's the next county in the state that is now infected with deer with CWD. Pat, you wrote up about it, did you not?
Yeah, I keep writing about it, and I just don't think it's something we should ignore, even though folks keep trying to ignore it and even seem confusing the issue quite a bit and claiming that something like epizootic hemorrhagic disease, EHD, is somehow a worse problem, which it is not, because it's such a short-term local type disease that sweeps in and pops up occasionally, but nothing enough to knock down a countywide or statewide deer herd. But, you know, we still have a hard time convincing people that when it shows up in a new area, that it's something to worry about. Folks want to continue doing things the way they've always done it. And what's interesting, though, is you go down into Iowa County and Richland County and Sauk County, Dane County, where it was, you know, first found back in 2002, and talk to folks down there who have seen the herds come down in their areas now, really come down hard in some areas. And they wish they could go back, turn the clock back, and keep that aggressive management going that we had going for the first few years before politics knocked it out, you know, where we had politicians stop us from doing the aggressive management. So I guess when we have folks today seeing CWD show up in their area, they should get their deer tested. They should bring it in, have it get tested, bring that sample in, and then keep an eye on things and press fellow hunters to get involved and care about it, because it's not going to behave a whole lot differently, especially in these counties northwest of those core counties where you have this real a lot of good forest cover across farm country up to Buffalo County, Pepin County, that area, this whole region along the Mississippi and inward. I think we're going to see in the next 20 years, I wouldn't doubt we're going to see the same problems pop up there that we saw, you know, that we see now going on in Richland County and those endemic areas.
Yeah. It's a very, very tough situation. It almost feels like there's that sort of more aggressive nature is going to have to aggressive work is going to have to be taken if there's ever any chance at all of it.
Right.
Well, Beth in Madison has a question relating to deer. Let's go there. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Larry. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm a pediatrician, and I'm always concerned about lead poisoning in children, and I'm concerned about the use of lead bullets that can actually get into the deer meat, and people can actually absorb it into their system. So I hope that you're encouraging people to use copper bullets instead of lead bullets.
Yeah, Beth, that's a very good point. Tim, you're nodding very... vigorously in agreement with what Beth has to say.
Yeah, she's right on, Larry, because that's something that really it's been knowledgeable now for about the last, 10, 15 years. I went to a meeting many years ago out in North Dakota, and there was a Dr. Kornatzer out there who was an avid deer hunter, and he had the inkling that maybe some of these lead bullets were fragmenting. And he actually took some venison, and then he had some X-rays made, and they could see the fragments of lead in the meat, and started getting the word out. And here in Wisconsin, back several years ago, one of the wildlife biologists, the late Carl Batha, who just passed away earlier this year, unfortunately, but Carl experimented because he wanted to find out if, you know, shooting lead bullets as compared to copper bullets, what the difference was. And he did the same thing. And it's interesting, when you see them, they set up these 1 gallon milk jugs filled with water, and they shoot the rifle into that, and then you see those lead fragments that are left in the bottles, in the water. And those are things that then are in the venison. So sometimes you can't hardly see it. So, I mean, really, it's worthwhile. And I've changed. I bought the copper bullets, and I think people, it's worth knowing about and hopefully changing and trying to use non-lead ammunition. Same thing, even small game hunting with, you know, pellets. If we could get rid of lead, it would really be, I think, a big benefit to us. But I think she's right on.
Yeah, and if you watch the Deer Hunt Wisconsin 2025, there within the video, in the video itself, there's a demonstration of that. And you look at that, and you wonder why anybody would want to continue to use lead in their hunting. I had copper bullets for many years myself. So, Beth, I thank you for that reminder. Margaret and Nina, we'll get to you in just a minute. A reminder here, we're talking to Tim Isley, Dean Bartz, and Patrick Durkin, our outdoor communicators, about what's going on in Wisconsin. We've zeroed in on deer a bit, but taking, obviously, any other questions relating to the out-of-doors. And you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking about Outdoors Wisconsin today with our three outdoor communicators, Tim Isley, Dean Bortz, and Pat Durkin. Again, if you want to join in, the number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Margaret and Nina, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I'm not a hunter. We live on the way western edge of Nina with a large natural area right beside our lot. We see lots of deer all year long, including other wildlife. The other day, I saw walking by my window a deer. I think it was a doe. Very, very dark charcoal, almost black color. I've never seen one that dark before. Then I heard that the darker the deer was as winter approached, the worse winter we're going to have. Is there any truth to that old wives' tale? I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, we need the weather guys who I have on the last Monday of the month, but I think, Pat, you've got a good answer there, I think.
Well, this is one thing I always enjoy about your show, Larry, is I hear things I've never heard before. And that's one I have not heard before. You know, I thought she's going to ask us about melanistic deer that almost are charcoal black because of, they're like the complete opposite of an albino deer. But no, you know, you can see variations in a deer's coat, you know, the colors. And I've seen deer that are darker than others, but I've never heard anyone tie it to a forecast of any sort, because you look at deer walking through the woods, even in groups, you'll see different shades of color, darkness on their hide. So I assume that this is probably just another little variation from what's normally seen in her area.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Margaret, there you go. Melanistic, you mentioned melanistic. So melanin, within the genetics there's a higher proportion of melanin, you're going to have a darker color.
Correct.
Yeah. That's what it is, Margaret. Thank you very much for calling. Jeff emailed in and never understood why hunters and farmers are so vehemently opposed to reintroduction of native predators like wolves, understands the need for tradition and so forth, but is just missing something from this type of perspective, and aren't there sufficient livestock reimbursement programs for farmers and ranchers who unfortunately lose animals to wolves and other predators. I think he may be wrong. Maybe I'll be wrong, but I'm not sure that the vast majority of hunters are opposed to wolves. Dean, do you a comment from you?
Sure. We could burn up your whole 2 hours of the show right here on this one topic. But, you know, I think you're right, Larry. I mean, by and large, and I guess I can't put a number on it as far as a percentage, but I would guess the large majority, maybe over 90% of our citizens, support the presence of wolves in Wisconsin. The differences lie in how we handle different situations. And, you know, farmers do have to deal with wolf presence on a higher level or more often than the average bear, the average citizen, I mean. You know, and I know some of these folks, and it's not easy to have, you know, so the person who wrote in talked about reimbursement program. That's for a dead animal, and only if it's a verified wolf depredation. There are a lot of animals that die that aren't confirmed as wolves, so they don't get reimbursed for those. And whether it's livestock or a pet or chicken or whatever it might be. So there's that part of it. But, you know, like I'm going to use their name because we've used it in print over the years. But there's two brothers up in the Danbury area, Burnett County. No, I think they're further up than Burnett. What is that? Anyway, the Fernangle brothers, they have a 1,000-acre beef ranch. You can't monitor 1,000 acres from a farmhouse. And their cattle get chased all the time. Now, they may not die, but all of a sudden they're dealing with vet bills and sick animals, agitated cows. You can't go in among them and give them shots that they, you know, you have to, every once in a while, you have to give them updated shots and stuff. So there's a lot of repercussions for livestock raisers or producers from having wolves around that most people don't realize. That's the hard part. And so how do we have keep wolves on the landscape at a level high enough or low enough, however you want to look at it, to allow them to be present here without, I'll say, inflicting that kind of negative experience to people who are around them more often than others. So that's just the beginning of it. We can go on and on and on with this thing here, but the main thing is we don't have an ability to manage wolves in Wisconsin because they're on the endangered species list. And once they get off of that and we are able to manage them at a state level, we'll find out then whether or not our wolf plan, our updated wolf plan, is going to be sufficient to manage the wolves, or we may have to update it even more.
While still maintaining a wolf population.
Right, right.
Thanks for that email, Jeff. Appreciate it very much. Todd in La Crosse wonders, was the rut all confused this year, perhaps because of the full moon? Todd has heard many hunters say they were not moving at the normal times and in the normal places. Pat?
Well, this is one of my all-time favorite topics, Larry. I've been asked that question and covered that question throughout my career. And the one thing I can tell you with absolute certainty is that no matter what I say about all the research showing that the moon is just not a factor in the rut, people will not believe me. They'll stay on the course they've always been on, and they'll basically call me names to my face sometimes about how I don't know what I'm talking about. But there is absolutely no research, and this has been researched to death, linking the moon to any kind of rutting activity. That the rut has always been and always will be dictated, the breeding cycles will be dictated by daylight, amount of daylight we have. And as we run in the fall and the days get shorter and shorter, usually it's like late October, things start getting active in the woods. And just because we might not see that deer activity while we're hunting doesn't mean it's not occurring. It often occurs at night, and the rut varies year to year, but every spring the deer are dropping fawns again. So obviously the breeding cycle has always continued throughout all these different variations we see in the fall. But the one constant is that our daylight and how it goes downhill in the fall gets less and less, triggers the rut, and off we go. And the deer the doe has to get impregnated by typically mid-November to early December, so that she drops those fawns at a good time of year, usually like late May, early June, so that they're healthy enough, big enough to survive the next winter. And that's just the way nature's designed it. And I just think when it comes to the rut, you should be out there as often as you can be, no matter the conditions. If you have a chance to be out in the woods, get out there. Don't worry about the moon phase. Just go hunting. That's the only way you're going to get them.
Okay. When we're thinking about hunting, and I was looking at the numbers last year. I think we, in the state, sold something like 791,000 deer licenses last year. And 189,000, or almost 190,000 deer were harvested. So that's a success rate of around 24% there, about, if my math is in my head is correct. So
I'll let you puzzle that one out, Larry. I'm not even going to try it with my head.
I think it's 24%, so close to 1 in 4 licenses resulted in a harvested deer. Now, the number of licenses has been dropping a little, Patrick.
Yeah. I know Dean loves it when I send in my articles sometimes, and it's pretty much just nothing but numbers, you know. And it's always, when I do that, it reminds me of, we're old enough to remember this great humorist, Pat McManus. And he used to talk about the ballistics guys, the guys who like talking high-powered rifle ballistics. And he said, these guys can write an entire sentence without using one word, just numbers. And that's kind of the way I am when it comes to deer numbers in Wisconsin. And the thing I'll share, I was looking it up this morning, and, you know, last year for our gun license sales, total gun license sales in Wisconsin, we were at basically 500 and, let me look here. Yeah, 555,000 and some change. And the last time we saw our total license sales in that region for gun season was 1974, when I was just getting out of high school. And we actually sold a few more licenses in 1974 than we sold last year. And so, we have our hunting population, deer hunting population, has dropped from a high of nearly 700,000 back in 1990.
That's
down
for
to
gun.
Now 555.
Yeah.
For the gun license. You know, we've seen an increase, a real slight increase in the archery / crossbow licenses, but it's up maybe 3,000 over the last, overall over the last 6, 7 years, 8 years. But the gun licenses, it's an interesting thing when you track it, how the 9-day gun season, I remember when biologists like Frank Haberlin back in my early days in the 80s, Frank Haberlin, the DNR, used to say that's our deer management hammer, the 9-day gun season. And you look at it, and back then, that era, 9-day gun season accounted for about 88% of our gun kill, our overall kill, and now it accounts for less than 60% of our overall kills. So it's not having the impact it had, when all of us were young.
John in Stoddard has a question, kind of relates in a way. John, hello.
Yeah, I was wanting to know more about studies that show the impact of the overabundance of deer on the landscape relative to hardwood forests. I was up in the Porcupine Mountains and saw an abundance of seedling trees, hardwood trees, primarily oaks. And I know oak is a favorite browse tree for deer. And I have very few in my forest, and it's dominated by maturing oaks, but there are no seedlings. And as a result, there's just tons of invasive buckthorn and honeysuckle and other things that the deer don't like to munch so much.
Yeah, the effects of deer on hardwood forests. I saw a little of that. I was in part of a group of people that were looking at various forest land in the northern part of the state, and the management, the native management in this particular part of the was quite different from the way the forests are managed. They have a different system for managing their deer, and it results in more of those seedlings getting growing up. And I know the DNR has done some exclosures in various forest lands where the deer can't get into a particular area, and the growth of the seedlings and so forth is far greater, Tim.
Yes, and I know, I think it's a professor, maybe he's retired now, Don Waller, I believe, from mm-hmm. botany at UW, has done a lot of research on that. And I mean, he's exactly right that it is having an effect on the woods. And I think there's a lot of concern about oaks, especially down in the southwest driftless region of Wisconsin. And, you know, the deer herd has an effect. And the interesting thing is when you do go to some of these places, like up north where you were, and you see these deer exclosures, and then you see what's growing inside the fence as compared with to what's outside the fence. And, I mean, I know down on our property now, down there in southwest Wisconsin, honeysuckle, you know, we've got honeysuckle, and there's some buckthorn, and then garlic mustard, and all of these species, and they keep growing. And then the oaks are getting nibbled away. It's an uphill fight to try and keep oaks on your property, and I think you have to try and manage specifically for it. And a lot of people are turning to fire, that, you know, a controlled fire, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a problem, and I think he's identified it correctly.
Yeah, Dean.
I think one of the differences that the gentleman, you know, what he saw up in the UP versus what he's seeing. Did he say he was in Stoddard, I think, Vernon County?
Yeah, Stoddard.
It's going to be deer numbers. There are just fewer deer up in the UP than there are in Vernon County. And if he wants to see seedlings, they're going to have to reduce deer numbers. And whether they do that by hunter harvest or, you know, I mean, nobody's going to be advocating bringing in more bears, bobcats, and wolves to Vernon County, I'm sure. But that's the difference. Hunter harvest and predation bring the herd down enough to a level where those seedlings can grow, because I'm seeing it in Ashland County where for years I never saw a young cedar tree. Now I'm seeing young cedar tree on my land.
Really interesting. Just one other on the exclosure, I can remember over in your area, Tim, they had an exclosure set up in an alfalfa field.
Oh.
And I saw a video of it, and you're looking at this alfalfa field. Oh, it looks pretty good. And then you get to the exclosure, and it's the alfalfa is twice as tall.
Sure.
As the alfalfa. So sometimes you don't notice it until you do something like putting an exclosure in to really see the amount of difference that can occur when something like that is instituted. Let's see. I'm looking at Dan in Platteville wrote us an email. He got three deer this fall with his bow, and every time the deer jumped when they heard the string and he missed them. He said, then they look at me before he can grab another arrow, and they bolt and wonders what he did. Well, Pat?
He's asking the deer basically eluded his arrow?
Yeah.
Yeah, with archery equipment, we call it jumping the string, and the deer aren't really ducking the arrow, even though it looks like it. But typically with a compound bow and recurve bow, you have to aim below them, especially if you're shooting like 15 yards and longer. You know, they'll hear that arrow being released, and they're a prey animal, and they respond quickly to anything that could be a threat. They don't look around for evidence of a threat. They respond instantly to a strange sound. So what they do is they'll duck, you know, basically coil their legs up, get ready to spring, and as they coil up to jump, their whole body drops down as they load up to spring, and so the arrow often goes right to the top of their back, and so the only way you can counteract that is that, like, I typically, when I aim with archery equipment, I'm aiming right above the where the white belly meets mm-hmm. the brown part of the hide. And the thing I can also tell you from experience now, in the late season, I'll hunt with a crossbow. And with a crossbow, they're fast enough, like another 100, 150 feet faster than an average compound bow. You don't need to aim low with a crossbow. They just put it on where you want to hit, and they'll deliver it. So that's the only advice I have. When you're hunting with archery, you got to aim a little bit low and just trust that deer to do what it always does, and that's, you know, duck down and get ready to jump away. And it's interesting, on video you can see it. You know, they draw a line where that deer's back is when the arrow was released, and then where they are when that arrow goes over their back, and it's like 6 inches, 12 inches lower. So it's pretty amazing. It gives you an idea how fast these animals can react.
Craig in West Central Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Craig.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for the subject. Comments earlier about the reduced the kill of deer, some observations I made. A group of us were just talking about this subject not long ago and why there is an excitement around deer hunting like there used to be, and the kill rates are down. You know, some of the things we did when we were kids, we used to go with, you know, the people we hunt with, and you go to a registration station, you get to see others, you run into neighbors and friends, and it built excitement and some tradition there. And now it seems like we're hunting in silos. You know, I understand the efficiency of registering game by phone and some of those things, and getting your license over the Go Wild site and things like that, and those efficiencies. But some of it was just people gathering with a common interest of deer hunting, getting to see others. It created excitement and tradition and things that you look forward to. And then it helped local gas stations with people coming in, and just added to the excitement. When you're a kid, that's a big deal. And it's still exciting, don't get me wrong, but some of that stuff went away. And just wondering if we'd ever revisit that.
Yeah, and there's the whole area of tags and tagging. I think the DNR, if I'm not mistaken, would prefer to have that reintroduced. Pat and Dean, I know, and maybe Tim too, has some thoughts on it. Let's go to Pat first and then Dean.
Well, this is always the concern when we went away from in-person registration, you know, 10, 11 years ago. And you know, I'm all for it. I really enjoyed those days when you could drop into a registration station on opening day, opening week, and it'd be this constant buzz of people and deer. And you'd always give you – one thing I loved about it is you could it'd give you a feel for that region's deer herd. I mean, we often hear the deer and I are talking in terms of the herd. But when you see all these pickup trucks rolling into those registration stations, deer legs sticking up everywhere in the back of these trucks, you start getting an idea that, yeah, there's a lot of deer out there in the landscape. And we've kind of lost that. The other thing we lost, besides the social aspects of that, was that it used to be much easier for the DNR and our Department of Health people to do checks. Like, they go in there and do a tick count on these deer, you know, check them to see what their tick load is, and they could get this pretty good information on where our tick problems are worst in this state. It made it very efficient for collecting scientific information. They'd also do things like check the deer's overall condition, their fat index, these kind of things. So I wish sometimes we had the power in our agency to do that, to go in and say this year, this county or this area, we're going to collect, you know, make it mandatory in-person registration. But we have not had the political backbone in recent years to just say we got to impose this in some areas at times to get a better feel for what's going on with the deer herd.
Yeah. Dean, anything to add there?
Sure. Yeah, and then just to add on to Pat's thoughts there, the aging thing. I mean, ever since we've the Deer Trustee Report has made deer hunting fun again, according to their words. I think the Deer Trustee Report took the fun right out of deer hunting. And when I say that, I mean it can still be fun. It's just not fun in the way it used to be with the lack of the registration stations and other things that that happened out of the Deer Trustee Report. But now our biologists have to try to get aging information in different ways, which means going to meat processors and stuff like that, where it's not as easy to track down. And you don't get the numbers of aging yeah. samples that you did at the registration stations. But the other aspect of it, the social, the traditional aspect of it that's gone now is, I hunt, by the time the muzzleloader season is done, I'm probably in four or five different counties. And no matter where I go, to whether it's a sports shop, gas station, tavern with a bar grill that had deer contests, buck contests, their number of entrants have dropped dramatically in the last 10 years, where they don't, I'll use Minocqua as an example, Island Sports Shop. Kurt Justice is the owner. He used to have close to 500 or over 500 entrants in there. And this last year he had 110. And the biggest deer brought in there was a 14-inch wide, maybe 15-inch wide 8-pointer. You know, in the past, that deer would have never had a chance of winning a big buck contest. It's just that it's really taken the wind out of that part of our deer hunt. And that's where, you know, as the gentleman said, when you're a kid, that's kind of the exciting part. You know, one of the exciting parts of deer hunting, you get to go in and look, see some of the stuff. Maybe you get to tell your own story. Older hunters see a kid bring a deer in. They want to ask the kid about the hunt. The kid gets, you know, to be part of the camaraderie and part of the fabric of deer hunting. That I shouldn't say it doesn't exist anymore, but it doesn't exist like it used to, and that's really sad.
Dean Bortz, Tim Eisley, and Pat Durkin, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we're talking about the book titled The Martians. It's a history of the alien craze at the turn of the century. Then we talk astronomy and what you can see in the night sky. Right now, we're talking Wisconsin Outdoors with our outdoor communicators, Tim Eisley, Dean Bortz, and Pat Durkin. Great to have them back with us. And Stephen Ladysmith has a question for you guys. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. Hi, guys. Hey, I love it when you're on. Dean, keep up the good work at the Outdoor News.
Thank you.
Just a quick observation. Maybe you guys know, when I was a kid in southern Wisconsin, coming up to hunt, deer hunt, of course, 10, 12 years old, always saw snowshoe hares. Don't see them at all. I don't know if you guys ever see them. Has the habitat changed that much, or they seem to be just gone? So
yeah. Well, I'm not sure if we've had. I can't recall seeing any numbers on snowshoe hare. Anybody have a thought on that?
The only thing I can say, Larry, is that I often hunt from Tom Heberlein's shack in Ashland County, central Ashland County, just southwest of Mellon. And it's just common to see the snowshoe hare population fluctuate. Some years you barely see a track, and other years their trails are everywhere. And as far as I know, that's always been that way. They've always been cyclic, and I don't know what else to say about. I have not heard anything recently about there being any overall concern of their overall health. But just in my experience, one man's observation is that it fluctuates greatly from year to year, and I couldn't even tell you right now what to expect for this year until I'm out there and seeing what's on top of the snow.
Yeah, if there is snow.
if there is snow, yeah.
It's, I think it's going to be 44 degrees in Hayward.
Yeah, yeah.
For the opening day of the deer season this year. Well, Tom in Minocqua has a question before our news break. Let's go there. Tom, hi.
Hi, Larry, guys. First of all, quick disclaimer. This is weird that I'm calling into a discussion on deer hunting because every year at Thanksgiving, I give thanks that my dad did not hunt and I did not have to hunt either because I can't imagine anything worse than going out in a dark, cold winter morning and sitting in a tree stand. But anyway, here's my question, because you'd probably argue the opposite of that. You're talking about how you missed the registration process that used to exist. And I kind of, as an outsider, it was kind of exciting to go to gas stations and see all this activity and stuff. Why did that change?
Well, Dean, go ahead.
I don't know if I remember exactly why it changed. I just remember that it did change. It came out of the Deer Trustee report, didn't it, Pat?
Correct, yeah. I think it was mainly viewed as a cost-saving move, efficiency. It does make things easier. You can just basically shoot a deer now, and if you have cell reception for your phone, you can register the deer right there in the field and be done with it. We're living in times when we're always complaining about government spending and budgets and stuff. And the DNR is one of those major agencies that's always being criticized for spending money. And this is one thing they could do and cut that service. But I think, as we said earlier, when you cut something like that, you lose something. And the only thing I can liken it to, Larry, is when it comes to the excitement, is I never did any running competition, 5Ks and that kind of stuff, marathons, whatever, until later in life. And the only thing that comes close to that experience of getting people together in one spot with a common purpose, a common excitement level, is when I hang out at the race after the fact, and people are happy. They've done something. They're talking to each other. They're talking to total strangers. And the only other place I see that in my life was around the deer registration station during the gun deer season.
Yeah. Dean, you were going to say something.
Oh, sorry. I was just looking at a text. Somebody was listening to the show. Let me know that earlier when we were talking about deer harvest numbers, we had mentioned 189,000. That was the gun kill.
Yes.
The total kill would have been 321,000. Sorry, I looked at my phone. I probably shouldn't have done that.
Well, that takes it up to 40%.
and then another caller or another listener texted in and said, I sounded awfully good on the radio, that I have a great face. great face for radio.
and Tim, so
I'll thank her. She's from Green Bay.
And Tom and Okano, in 30 seconds, have you got something to add to the snowshoe hares?
Yes, snowshoe hares have basically flatlined in north central and northeastern Wisconsin since the late 1980s when the Fisher took off. That is a big part of their winter eating besides deer gut piles.
Fishers, yeah. And that's another animal I see a lot in the North Woods when I'm sitting on a deer stand or out in the woods. Well, we're going
to see them like I used to. I mean, they skyrocketed initially, now, but they've
come back
off.
Down. They have. Yeah. Tim Eisley, freelance outdoor writer, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, and Pat Durkin, freelance writer, editor, and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, our guests, and they'll be with us till 1 o'clock. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking about the world of wildlife today with our outdoor communicators, Dean Bortz, who is editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance writer and photographer. Great to have them with us. And you can join in with your own questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email to talk at WPR.org. Somebody sent a note that through Monday, November 17th, more than 106,000 whitetails have been registered statewide this fall. That's a 10% increase from last year, 10% higher than last year. Rick Inciano has a question or comment relating to deer registration, I believe. Rick, hello.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
I just want to touch on the what some people would call tradition of gathering at a registration station and what you guys were touching on before the break. Nobody's stopping anybody from still gathering there. Nobody's saying you can't go show off your harvest. Nobody's, and that seems to be what they want to do is show this off, like it's some type of, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, with Tim?
Sure. Well, yeah, he's right. You still can go somewhere, so although there aren't the established registration stations that there used to be. And it was just a social get-together for people, and it's sort of, personal interest of what's going on in the area. Are other people getting deer? I'm not seeing deer. What type of deer are they getting? So these are questions that, you know, it's just sort of a nosy thing that hunters like to do. I also thought that the advantage to the registration stations, the other advantage, basically I thought it was so much easier for the DNR to have people there to take CWD samples. So, I mean, if you're not going to be taking it in anywhere, you know, you register it with your cell phone or whatever, you know, and nobody sees that deer. But if you take it to the registration station, then there was the opportunity for either a local taxidermist or a DNR employee to take the sample, the lymph node, for a CWD check. And I think that was really important, and I would like to see that again.
Yeah, absolutely. Rick, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Kim in Eau Claire, we'll go to you. Hi, Kim.
Hello, guests. I just wanted to share an experience many years ago out bow hunting up in a tree, and there were squirrels being chasing each other around a tree, and an owl flew by and landed and missed them, and it sat on the limb, and I was just sitting motionless, and it started flying. I thought it was going to fly by me, and I had my bow in my hand, and the owl started landing on the limb of my bow, and its wings hit my shoulders as it landed, and I went whoa and tilted the bow away from me, and it leapt over onto a limb probably 10 feet away from me and sat there for probably 3-4 minutes looking at me, and I was motionless, and it would turn, and it would blink, and I would blink, and finally it flew away. But I realized I had a rabbit hat on.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I've had twice in my life had one time a little screech owl, and one time a hawk came in to just kind of swooped in to check me out. And what I found fascinating is I could tell that little owl was locked on my eyes. That's the only thing that was really visible I can't remember what I had, something in a head net that only my eyes were showing. And it must have seen my head move a little bit and came right in. And so, yeah, it's one of those fun things about hunting is you don't know what you're gonna see sometimes. You're out in the woods, and sometimes they actually are a little bit targeting you. It's pretty unusual for something to actually get hurt, you know. But it's interesting. I can see where it could happen by accident, especially if you're wearing a a rabbit fur hat.
Kim, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Appreciate it. Janice in northern Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Janice.
Hi. I'm from rural northern Wisconsin, from a deer, gun hunting culture. Understand the need for keeping the herds in because my garden gets eaten every year. But more and more people are moving into the rural areas. Every 10 acres, every 5 acres, every 20 acres, there's homes being built, less and less land, open land for deer hunting. So what's the future of hunting? What I'm wondering is there research being done on deer contraceptives? I'd be glad to put out salt wax with contraceptives or anything like pheromones to disrupt the rut because, you know, that'd be a natural way to have fewer fawns. I approve of bears and wolves and coyotes, but that also is not a good solution for these built-up areas. So is there any research being done?
Dean Bortz, we'll turn to you. Thanks, Janice. Dean?
Well, I had not given this a whole lot of thought until she called in, so I think what we probably ought to do is put together a project at Wisconsin Outdoor News, and we'll have Tim and Pat work on that one and see what they can come up with.
Yeah, Pat, comment?
Yeah, actually, she raises a point that there has been research on this, and there's actually been programs where they tried to control deer herds, and I think one of them is on one of the New York City boroughs. They were actually, every male deer they found, they would sterilize it and give it a vasectomy. So this has been done. Now, its effectiveness for anything that's free-ranging, though, is just not going to work. And even if you could disrupt their pregnancies or delay their pregnancies, I mean, when it comes to contraceptives, that's been looked at. And what they found in some cases, what they found eventually happens is that when you start delaying that deer's pregnancy and maybe it doesn't get pregnant the first time around and the contraceptive wears off and they get pushed into, let's say in our country, December and January, well, the does often still get impregnated at some point. The bucks are persistent. And as long as that doe is throwing off the scent that she's receptive, they can get bred in December and January and even February. And then you have a situation where the fawns are born in midsummer, and so they go in the winter undeveloped, not mature. And then all you're doing is setting up a cycle of premature death, a long death for these fawns when they come into winter. So to me, you're just messing with nature. When you start messing with nature, you have unintended consequences. And so I guess I always struggle with these kind of questions because I think, why are we messing with wildlife with that? We're even struggling to even manage what we have right now with hunting. So I think it's going to be those kind of things. I just have, unless you can control that population, let no new deer come in and no deer escape. They're already stuck in that island, so to speak. You might be able to do something, but in the long term, no, it's just not going to happen. Unless you have a way to keep those deer from coming in and repopulating from outside the area, it's just not going to happen.
Ron in Manitowoc County has something, I think, relating. Ron, hello.
Oh, thanks, Larry. Comments on deer population. Was or is a professor at Cornell, Blousy, I believe his name is. He did quite a bit of research on deer population. And one of the items he came up with was the need to eliminate 2/3 of the females to have a lasting effect on the population, in that as the environment is better for the deer, as population goes down, more multi-births are produced. Also, there's a book out by a Wisconsin deer hunter, Deerland, and Larry may have had him on many, many years ago. In the book, the author indicates about 1.5 tons of feed is consumed every year by a deer. And when you look at 20 or 40 in an alfalfa field and do the multiplication at $100 or $140 a ton for hay or the outer rows of a corn crop, there's a massive cost to farm people because of the massive number of deer. Also, the insurance rates on vehicles in the state due to the collisions between the animals, the Lyme disease, the possible jumping of species of CWD. We have to change our culture, I think, as far as how we view these animals.
Ron, thank you very much for calling. Comments from our panel here?
I think one of the issues I think is we're really fighting with right now is that we have a growing deer herd. You can look at all the data the DNR puts out there, and it's pretty interesting. You look across the North Woods, and the population from that region, you see the typical up and down graphs, and with the population heavily being dictated by the winter. And herd, when the winter is not severe, and you have a couple of years back-to-back mild winters, the deer herd in northern Wisconsin starts going up. You have a harsh winter, it goes down. You get mild winters, and it goes back up again. And so natural fluctuations we've seen as long as we've been trying to manage deer. But then you get down into the farm country, and the graph shows from like 2000 on just a steady increase going on up and up and up. And so I think unless we find ways to get the hunting population that we do have, that we still have, to take more deer, we're going to have problems. And it's going to show up with more dead deer in the highway, more crop damage, more over-browsing of the forest habitats. Like the guy mentioned earlier, that the oak regeneration, you can't get an oak to grow in some of these areas without putting a tube around the sapling while it's growing, because the deer will chew them off. And these are all issues that come up with when you have overabundant deer.
And Jim in Appleton has something that relates to this. Jim, what's on your mind?
Oh, and you talk about the quality and the interest in hunting. Years ago when they went to a hunter's choice permit instead of the old party permit where you needed four guys to send in, now one guy can. And then when they started baiting, now somebody with an acre or two of land could put bait out, climb up a tree and sit there and hunt by himself. And when I started hunting in the 60s, it was always with uncles and friends, and it was a vacation. You look forward to it. And nowadays, everybody I know just goes out and climbs up a tree and hunts by himself all day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's some truth to that, Tim.
Yeah, and I think the comment that the gentleman made about the deer population and needing to shoot more does, you know, it goes back to Aldo Leopold. And when he actually was serving on the Conservation Commission in Wisconsin, and he was trying to, he went through the deer wars. Basically, he was trying to say you needed to shoot more does. And he was receiving so much resistance to that. And there was even somebody, I remember, that he had written about, or that Nina Leopold Bradley had written about, the fact that he was so disappointed because he had a friend who also served on the Conservation Commission, and that person didn't agree with him on shooting more does. So, I mean, it was really tough to make that sale, but the need to shoot more does to keep the deer population in check was back then, and, you know, consistent, I think, to now.
And Jim, thank you for calling. Tim Isley, Dean Bortz, and Pat Durkin are outdoor communicators. Our guests, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk. Take a look at the Wisconsin outdoors with our three guests, Tim Isley, Dean Bortz, and Pat Durkin. Darlene and Viola has something. Let's go there. Darlene, hello.
Yes, hi there. I'm going to limit my comments to to your topic of wildlife. I live in God's country. It's called the Driftless Area. Many people get their main meat from deer, venison, of course. And there's going to be a potential existential threat to all of the wildlife. We're not even talking about the people here. based on what is being proposed for the largest electric transmission line coming through and scarring our landscape and hills and valleys, 765 kV transmission line, plus the existing lines that are already in the corridors that they are considering. These lines are unprecedented. They've never been in Wisconsin before. If you travel south into Illinois or west into Minnesota, you will see these humongous 200-foot towers carrying almost a million volts of electricity overhead. They will also produce coronas, which are glowing lights, if you will, based on certain environments, weather patterns, rather, and hissing sounds. Now, it's been proven that wildlife does not like this. And we're talking honeybees, too. We're not just talking four-legged warm animals that are on the ground. They are very sensitive to these lights and sounds. They will scatter. And remember that Wisconsin is a big hunting area called money. And if that happens, it's going to be affecting the pocketbooks of the state.
Tim, I know you're quite familiar with this area. I'll let you comment.
Sure. Thank you, Larry. Yes, I agree. I think what she is talking about is this very new proposal. I think it's called Maribel, which is coming down from southeastern Minnesota, crossing the river, coming down through Wisconsin, Vernon County, Crawford County. And it's a huge, big power line, which basically is going to be wider, it's going to be taller, it's going to cause an awful lot of disturbance. And people are just waking up to it now. We happen to be affected because we are a landowner in Crawford County, and it is going to go across our land, so we are very concerned. You know, it's the type of thing, she referred to it, you know, any of us who drive down to Chicago or down to O'Hara Airport, you know, and you go down on the interstate, you hit that area and you see these huge, big conglomerations of power lines and big metal structures, and it just sort of takes your breath away. You'd like to get back to beautiful Wisconsin. Well, that's what we're going to have here, and so we're really concerned. And I think, you know, we need power, and we need solar, and we need wind, but hopefully there can be what we need is to have it local. I mean, we ought to be having solar panels on all of our houses. We ought to be doing things rather than these huge, big lines going all over. And I think it is going to disrupt an awful lot of things. There's a meeting tomorrow. In fact, I'm going to go to it up in Westby. Dairyland Power Company had meetings in Minnesota the last 2 days this week. And tomorrow it's going to be up in Westby, where people will have some of the first chance to learn. There's a lot that we don't know about it, but it's going to really disrupt things. I think the habitat, but also just the view of southwestern Wisconsin. And you know, there's over, I don't know, something 50,000 miles of power lines in this state. And basically, power line owners and the private landowners that they go over, they should be partners. They ought to be able to work together. A lot of that ought to be able to be kept in prairie and wildlife habitat. So they ought to work together. And so maybe, hopefully, there's something that'll come out of this that'll be an improvement. But there are a lot of concerns right now, and I agree with her. Anybody in that area, I would certainly recommend that they go to the meeting in Westby and learn, because there's a lot we don't know right now.
Mm-hmm. Darlene, thank you very much for calling. Sherry and Spooner has a question along a different line. Let's go there. Hi, Sherry.
Darlene, thank you very much for calling. Sherry and Spooner has
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Sherry.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question about the Wisconsin Conservation Congress and how you guys see it the changes in the Conservation Congress affecting things these days, with more people attending the Congress meetings, more people voting for conservation of habitat, and maybe less hunters and trappers voting. I'm not really sure about that, but in our county, there was a big change in how things went, and I think that it's good for Wisconsin to focus on conservation of habitat, not only for hunting and trapping and fishing, but for other recreational and protection of our wildlife. What do you think of this?
Okay, thoughts on that? Dean Bortz.
I have to say that I'm not a fan of the online voting. And maybe it's because I go back far enough to where I, you know, attended most of those meetings in person, and I got to see, you know, in primarily in Vilas and Oneida counties, and I got to see the policies and procedures play out on the floor of local gymnasiums, libraries, and stuff, and I miss that. I think that really helped the process. I think now a lot of people probably vote without knowing the full ramifications of what they're voting on, whereas in the in-person hearings, if you attended, you'd get to hear a lot of discussion about that. And I know that they would often drag on till 11 o'clock at night, sometimes even midnight. But I really enjoyed that. And maybe that's just me, but I would not mind seeing the online voting go away.
Yeah. Pat, you were going to add something?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with the online voting. I mean, when I look at the results of it, compare it to previous years, you know, there is increased participation. And typically what you're seeing from the online versus the in-person, there haven't been that many really huge differences showing up in the data so far in the voting results. But I agree with Dean. I still think there's a certain value in people coming together at these meetings and hearing each other talk and seeing each other and being able to look the representatives in the eye and talk about stuff. Plus, these hearings would often attract the local state senator or state representative to come in and listen in. So these are good opportunities. The other thing I worry about with less people showing up at these spring hearings now is that we're not seeing. It was always tough to get people to basically throw their hat in the ring and represent their county in the statewide conferences and these different committees we have in the Conservation Congress. And I know when I talk to the current leadership, the chairman these days for a long time now has been Rob Bowman. And Rob worries that, you know, there's not many guys coming in that can want to step up and replace him. So he's kind of hanging on every year to year as a chairman because no one else wants the job. So you're not seeing that, I think, a good rotation of new talent coming in. And you kind of stuck with us old guys hanging on to these jobs because no one else wants them.
Yeah.
That's a problem also, though, that a lot of conservation organizations are having. You go to these meetings, and you just don't see the young people. You know, I agree with Dean and Pat in that going to the meetings physically and hearing from people and the discussion and all that is good, and you do learn. I, however, though, really think that the online voting allows more people to have input, and I think that's good because I think conservation and natural resources has got to be broad. We've got to get everybody involved. And it's easier. Sometimes, you know, some of the groups will get up and they'll just sort of hog the stage and talk for so long that some of the people will fade off into the distance. I think having some way that everybody can participate is good. And so from that standpoint, I like the online voting.
Let's turn to a different topic, ducks. And Tim, you have some news to share about duck meat and PFAS, of all things. What's happening in the Green Bay area?
Yeah, well, that was sort of surprising that earlier this fall, the Department of Natural Resources, basically they were sampling, which they do every year, they were selecting samples from some of the local birds up around Green Bay. They were looking for polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs. Well, all of a sudden, what they did is they came up finding PFAS in the meat that in these ducks. So basically what they did is they put out an advisory telling people basically to limit their consumption of mallards and wood ducks. And there were two areas. One was Lower Green Bay, Longtail Point across to Point Ausable, and then south to the Fox River, and then Green Bay from the city of Marinette across to Sturgeon Bay and south to the Longtail Point. So this was really concerning. I mean, it, basically that the PFAS was getting into the meat, and they wanted to know how it got there. So the department this fall, they're asking, so they've got some duck hunters who are going to be harvesting birds and turning in some samples from some of the birds that they harvest to find out, because these were local birds, so probably local breeding birds. Is it something that's just there, or is this wider spread, and is this in other migrating birds? So they're going to be testing those other birds and finding out. But it's the type of thing, you know, the saying of you are what you eat. You know, you have to be so careful about what you're eating. I remember there was a case back several years ago where there was somebody who lost his hunting privileges in Wisconsin, but then he went up and he harvested a deer out of state and brought it in and basically was saying that where he harvested somewhere else. Well, it didn't turn out that's where he harvested it. And then they were able to take samples from the antlers, and they matched it with the soil, and they found, and they were able to prove that he didn't harvest it where he said he did. So, you know, the point is, all this stuff, it can be in the meat, it can be in the antlers, these chemicals that are out there in the environment, we've got to be so careful of. And so they're checking on it. And it's going to be very interesting to see if this is in other migratory birds or if it was just very local there around Green Bay. But duck hunters up there should keep an eye open in that area.
There are actually PFAS advisories for deer hunters in the town of Stella.
Stella, exactly.
And then Marinette, in Oneida County.
Right. And if you look in your hunting regulation pamphlet later on, towards the end of the pamphlet, they've got a lot of advisories in there. So it's worth taking a look at that to know where those advisories are and be aware of that.
Dean, as part of your job, you collect monthly game warden reports. What surprises you, or is there anything that surprises you when you read these reports?
Well, we probably should not be surprised any longer. I mean, I think we've learned a long time ago, or saw a long time ago, that some people do some really stupid things. But I think I know what you might be getting at, Larry. And I guess my thought there is, I've been watching how I always refer to it as the Bureau of Law Enforcement. That's the old name. I can never remember what the new name is because it starts with safety and something else. And law enforcement is at the end of the name now. That's probably about 30 miles long. But, you know, back in the day, and when I say back in the day, it's probably only about 10, 12 years ago that the DNR got rid of the park ranger force or service. And now we have game wardens working in state parks. And it just seems to me like when I see the game wardens, you know, these reports coming through where they're, you know, pulling over an OWI driver in a state park, or responding to barking dogs in a state park, or some group is too loud too late at night and the game warden has to go deal with that. It just seems like our game wardens are trained to a level to where, you know, that work could be done by somebody else. We don't need game wardens handling that. And I'd like to get back to the days when we had a park service, ranger service, and they handled all the park stuff. Our wardens were out working on the lakes and in the woods, handling poaching cases and other things. So that's kind of what I've been noticing a little bit when these reports come through. Although now the series of reports I just edited for the next issue, I don't know if somebody has been getting wind of that or what, because now all of a sudden I'm seeing a lot of poaching cases popping up in the reports. And fewer mentions about state parks.
Interesting. That is interesting. Jeff Pritzel is retiring from the DNR. That was an interesting guy because I think he took a demotion in rank to become the deer program specialist because there were some things he wanted to change. And I know, Dean, you're familiar with him.
Right, yeah, I've worked with Jeff. Well, Tim and Pat have, too. We've all worked with Jeff over the years during his... I think he has to be there now 7, 8 years, maybe a little bit longer. I'm bad at time, so it could... If I say 7, it's probably more like 14, but Jeff's done a good job. He's a serious, conscientious guy. You know, he wants to see things done right. He tries to do things right as well as he can within the constrictions of the agency and the bureaucracy. So I'm going to be sorry to see him go. Always great to work with. He's always looking ahead and trying to see what he could do to improve deer management, the deer management process within our framework. And so when hunters from the north came to him about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, to talk about trying to get back to the old numbered unit, deer unit system that we had, Jeff was very supportive, and he worked quietly within the agency to get this done. And if people, I'm sure people, most deer hunters have seen this by now, but this year we do have a new deer unit management, deer unit structure in place. In the Central Forest and Northern Forest, where we do have numbered units. Now, they're not the same numbered units we had 12, 14 years ago, but they are numbered units, which should allow the biologists there to use our SAK system to, again, try to track deer populations.
Interesting thing as well. And these habitat-based units are make more sense.
Well, yeah, to me they do, and I don't know why we ever, well, I know why we went away with them, but we didn't go away from them for good reason. It was a couple of individuals who got a hold of a couple of politicians' ears, and they were able to make the change against a lot of, I'll say caterwauling from the rest of us, but it went through, and now we finally got a little bit of it back, and you know, hopefully it works out. We'll have to wait and see how this goes. I mean, it'll be a little while. Take a couple of years to figure out how this is working, but I hope it works well, and that we can expand it.
Tim, you were going to add to that.
I was just going to add just a comment regarding Jeff's retirement, which you're exactly right. He's been very good to work with, but you know, it's not surprising that we found the DNR employees. These people are dedicated. I mean, they dedicate their life to natural resources. And it wouldn't surprise me if Jeff would turn up somewhere as a volunteering, look back at other people. And Pat had written about, and we have also Keith McCaffrey. You know, Keith is someone who has been a deer ecologist for years and years. And after he retires, he shows up for work at the office and is there for a long time. People like Ed Frank retired from the DNR and wildlife, and he's doing help out with the Sharptail Grouse Society, the National Wild Turkey Federation, Don Bublitz. A lot of these DNR retirees, they get involved in these different programs, in these different organizations, basically to benefit the resource. I mean, they're living their life dedicated to natural resources, and I think we owe them a vote of thanks.
Yeah, I would agree. And Tim, just as long as we're on to you, the report came out about how the DNR uses license money for the Fish and Wildlife account. Tell us about those findings.
Right. Well, that was a legislative audit study that came out because the department has been short in its budget in the Fish and Wildlife account, basically, which is funded by fishing, hunting, and trapping licenses. And so it's been short. And in fact, they've had to make do with transferring money, sometimes from tribal gaming. This year and the last biennium, it was from forestry account, putting it in to the Fish and Wildlife account. And so the department has been short of funds in that account. And so legislators, they have had requests by sportsmen, we want to see an increase in licenses. And they were questioning that. They said, well, we don't know if they're funding it, if they're doing the right thing with their funding. So they asked the Legislative Audit Committee to come out and take a look at it. And they did an audit, and they finally came out with their results. And basically, the results were pretty good. I mean, that they found there were several things. They determined one thing was that at least 50% of the Fish and Wildlife account expenditures were specifically for benefited hunters and anglers. And then another 40% benefited hunters and anglers and other uses. And then there was 10%, which was for administration, which the Department of Administration allows agencies to use 10% for administration. It came up that there was 3%. In other words, 0.3% that did go to other uses. And basically, some of the politicians in the state were putting out some news releases saying, hey, they weren't spending it wisely, that here was going to other uses. My take on that was that we have a Department of Natural Resources. It's not just a game department. It's a Department of Natural Resources. And so if some of this money were to go to eagles and herons and other species and some research, I didn't see a big problem with that. But it was only 0.3%, really. So basically, it was a pretty positive response. I know the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation seemed to indicate that it was a positive audit. And so now the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation they have a committee that's been studying for part of a year to come up with some ideas to try and offset this funding shortage in the fish and wildlife account. A lot of people have asked for higher hunting and fishing licenses. So they're taking a look at things, and they're going to try and come up with some other ideas. You know, I know Minnesota uses this 0.8% of the sales tax, which goes into natural resources, which is great, and it's a great way to get the general public to contribute. Because right now, unless you've got a hunting license in your pocket, you're not funding the fisheries, the wildlife, or the law enforcement activities of our Department of Natural Resources. So we've got to get the non-hunters, they got to have some skin in the game. And I think they want to have.
Yeah. Dean, you wanted to add something.
Not so much that I wanted to add something to what Tim is talking about right now, but just before we run out of time, circle back to what we had talked about earlier, where Tim was mentioning about how many different individuals we have within the agency who did so much over all the years. And that brought to mind George Meyer for me. I just wanted to get in a second here to just thank George for everything that he's ever done for the DNR, for Natural Resources Conservation in Wisconsin. He's gone above and beyond time and time again. And I just want to thank him specifically for everything that he's done.
Yeah, you know, and he then became the executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. He upped the image of the Wildlife Federation and the influence that they had. And he then took on the job of this solar array up there and the prairie chickens in Plainfield. And because of his legal knowledge, he got that thing changed and really came out with a wonderful agreement, which they didn't have earlier. And George deserves lots of kudos.
Yeah. Yep.
Let's take a call from Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Kurt, hello.
Before I ask my question, I want to affirm what seems to be the subtext of your guest's comments this morning with regard to political interference. If you're going to have a decently run business or a department, in this case, a DNR, you set the policy, you get good people in there, and then you leave them alone and let them do their job.
Exactly.
That's my thinking. Okay, other than that, my question is, does the changes that your guests are saying are mostly negative with regard to deer management over the last years, does that have anything to do with, I think it was Governor Scott Walker when he brought in that guy from Texas who was going to reform and revamp the entire DNR, or at least the deer management part of it, some years ago? Does that have anything to do with some of the things that they're complaining about?
The deer czar from Texas. Well, I think Tim, I think you certainly have a thought on that. Well, Dean, let me go to Dean because I know Dean has to leave early today, so I want to get him to comment.
Right, I do have to leave early, and before I do, I just want to thank you, Larry, for inviting me on again, as well as Pat and Tim. It's always a pleasure to come on here. But to the gentleman's question, the short answer is absolutely yes.
Absolutely, yes. And on that note, we'll take a quick break. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for listening in today. Dean Bortz had to leave because he had a previous meeting. Dean, of course, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. But Pat Durkin and Tim Isley still with us to answer your questions. Tim, understand you attended the 80th celebration of the O'Hara Fishing Club.
Oh, you're right, Larry.
Madison. What's the history of that club?
Oh, that club, I mean, it goes back to the 1940s when they started out. And basically, they have helped basically taken an interest in the, all of the lakes and the rivers around Madison, Dane County, and southern Wisconsin. And what they did is that they had helped the city. They actually helped put in some boat ramps, and they helped construct piers for disabled fishing. And they put in money to so many different places around Madison to help fishermen and taken an interest in the quality of the lakes. There's a gentleman there, in fact, they honored Jack Hurst, who's 92 years old here in Madison, and Jack has been a stalwart of the O'Hara Fishing Club. They've had several of them, but Jack is just a really good one who has stood up, and he's basically taken a big interest in Warner Park and in some of the things that were done over there that basically they had to redo because they were filling in the waterways. He wants to improve the lagoons over there for fishing, but he's just an example of somebody who has done so much. And the fishing, all of the Madison Lakes, the O'Hara Fishing Club has just been a real leader in looking at the quality of the lakes and defending the lakes. So I take my hat off to him. Yeah, I was really pleased to be there at that banquet.
The Natural Resources Board and the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection just held a joint meeting, I think it was last week. What's the significance of this meeting?
Well, that's also, if I can just chime in on that one,
yeah.
I was there at that meeting. The last time that the DNR, the Natural Resources Board, the policy setting board for the Department of Natural Resources, and the DATCAP board, the last time they met was in 2004. And those two agencies have got so much in common. The forestry, you know, the forest pests, as far as surface water, groundwater, even chronic wasting disease, as far as deer farms and the wild deer, they've got a lot in common. And they haven't met since 2004 jointly. So this was an opportunity. They met at the DATCAP building out on the southeast side of Madison. And they, both of the boards, got reports from the staff people at DNR and at DATCAP on some of those different things. The similarities and what each of the employees were working on and had a chance to ask questions. I thought it was good, and I think it needs to be done more often because agencies have got to work together. And so I think that was it was a highlight that they did meet last week.
And I'm going to turn to Pat for a minute, well, and Tim joining in too, perhaps. The Trump administration proposed the limiting of the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to restrict pollution in wetlands and other bodies of water all around the country, which would include Wisconsin, of course. What do you make of this proposal?
I'm really worried about Larry. You know, they're talking about turning back regulations and overall system of managing our waters and wetlands that we brought into effect back in 1972, you know, 53, 54 years ago. And the thing that always worries me with this stuff, Larry, is that, you know, when things had gotten pretty dire in our country by the 1960s and early 70s, and there was very good reasons for our country to come together, and this happened during the Nixon administration where he passed the the water protection rules for our country and had the Environmental Protection Agency created. And so we had really good reasons for putting these policies into effect. Well, now we've been living with the overall good outcomes of that. And I think what happens so often with these kind of things is that we've gotten used to overall clean water, clean air, and we start thinking it was always like this. And we don't seem to realize that if we start turning the clock back again, that we're not going to end up in the same situations we were in when we had this all turn around 50 years ago. And so I see this kind of thing, and I understand it's clear that we have a hard time passing the regulations and the permits allowing the permits for construction of various building projects. I understand that's a problem sometimes getting those through these various agencies we have in our country. But the problem is, I think a lot of times the reason we're having a hard time processing those studies, processing that those permits, is because we keep cutting and cutting and cutting to these agencies to the point where there's not much staff to do the work that gets these permits checked off and processed. So, you know, so we basically back these agencies in their corner and then say, see, the system doesn't work. And the thing I would say is that the system works when you staff it properly and don't keep cutting these public servants and cutting off these jobs that they do. So I it's a long-winded answer, but I guess I get frustrated when I see these kind of turn back the clock legislation and thinking we're going to have happy times again. And I just don't think it'll work that way.
Yeah. One other point I wanted to be sure to mention was there was a public hearing on establishing a crane hunt in Wisconsin. Tim, I know you were at that. And I should mention, we're going to be talking about the crane hunt topic tomorrow at 9 on our Wisconsin Today program. But
good.
How well attended was the hearing, Tim?
Well, I was up there this morning. The Senate Sporting Heritage Committee had the hearing on the proposed bill to start a hunting season on sandhill cranes. And there, the room was packed. It was standing room only, and they had other people then in a backup room. And so, and I had to leave early to get over here. So I can't tell you all about all of the testimony, but there were a lot of people there on the side of sandhill cranes saying, hey, this isn't right for Wisconsin. There were also people there representing many of the different hunting interests, saying that it is about time that we have a hunting season in Wisconsin. I'm an avid hunter. I do everything because I hunt. I'm wearing a pin right now from my grandfather's license in 1930. So my family were hunters, and I love to hunt. But I just don't think a sandhill crane season is right for Wisconsin. There are many different reasons for that. But what we need, because I think it's going to separate hunters and non-hunters. It just put a bigger wedge in there. I think we can have both groups get together and work on the things that we really need to. And some of the proposals for corn damage, a season in the fall fall is not going to do anything, I don't think, for crop damage in the spring. And it's a sociological thing. I think they should have come through the Natural Resources Board. I'd like to have seen them discuss it, because that's where you get the biology, you get the sociology, and then they come together. I would much rather have seen the Natural Resources Board discuss this in the legislature. And when you get the politicians involved in it, that's why we can't have Ernebuck in Wisconsin. We can't have outlaw baiting in Wisconsin because of the politicians, what they've done. And I think it's going to really harm deer hunting and increase chronic wasting disease. So it's going to be interesting to see what happened.
And one final note, Jim had emailed us and said, why don't people advocate for the harvesting of fawns? They're the veal of the deer species, good eating, and would do more to bring down their numbers than shooting does. I remember, well, go ahead, Dean. Patrick, excuse me.
Well, the late Professor Orrin Rongstad always advocated for shooting fawns. Because he'd always point out that in the natural world, in the world of predators, they will always take the animal that they can deal with most efficiently. So quite often it's either the sick animal or the small young animals that predators take down. And so he always said that deer hunters should do the same. We should focus our efforts more on the fawn population to control the herd.
And on that note, we are out of time. Tim, Pat, and Dean, thank you all very much for being with us. Tim Isley, freelance outdoor writer. Pat Durkin, a freelance writer, editor, and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Dean Bortz, of course, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. Big thanks to them. Thank you for listening, and a big thanks to our team. Claire Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.